Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Hollywood's problem with addressing disability.
The disabled narrative is very singular in that people come into disability, and it's never that they're born with it. So it's always like, oh no, look at the life that they had before, and now they're sad and depressed, and how dare someone love them? And then someone might love them, but they'll end up killing themselves before the end of the movie or the TV show. And that's frustrating to me, because I live my life leading with joy now, and I want to see characters that do the same thing. I want to create characters that do the same thing.
This hour will explore one woman's journey to embracing her disability and the role it plays in advocating for real representation in media. That's after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Kia Brown says she isn't defined by cerebral palsy, but it's hers. For years, she avoided mirrors and laughed off jokes made at her expense. She's described her disability as both beautiful and frustrating, but it wasn't until she accepted her disability and embraced it that she found joy. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Kia Brown created the viral hashtag #DisabledAndCute and has watched her social media following explode as she fiercely advocates for disability representation in Hollywood and the fashion industry. Her deeply personal book is called The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. She joined us last year to talk about it, and today we're listening back to our conversation. Kia, welcome to Think.
Hi, Courtney. Thank you for having me.
So, Kia, I think we need to start with the ponytail. Why was the day that you put your hair in a ponytail such a celebration for you?
Because I couldn't do it beforehand. I think I'm a person who really is into celebrating small wins. And for me, that was a major small win because I was always having to ask for help with my hair. And any sort of independence that I can garner in this lifetime, especially as a disabled person who wants to be seen as a fully realized human being, to be able to put my hair up by myself was really a life-changing moment simply because I never could before. And a lot of people don't think about the reality of sometimes not being able to do simple tasks and how there's so much privilege in being able to do them outright. And so for me, to celebrate that was really to celebrate myself and the growth that I was making in terms of my own independence.
And you really went through something. It's not like you just said, it's difficult to do this, so I'm not going to try, or just figured it out one day. You really like workshopped the ponytail. You had claw clips, you had different things you tried, YouTube tutorials, and you just fought for it. You weren't going to give up on this.
Yeah, I mean, I was more motivated to do this thing than I was for a lot of things at that time. I was like, I can't give up. I have to keep going because I was going to be so disappointed in myself if I gave up. Now, I've given up on a lot of things in my life, but I really wanted to be able to do this specific thing so that when I was out with my friends, I didn't have to ask them for help. For me, it was a sign of trying to find my own, you know, sense of beauty and sense of worth, even if it was in a ponytail. I think it was the start of me finally feeling good about myself.
Can you describe some of the physical limitations of cerebral palsy for folks that might not be familiar?
Absolutely. So my cerebral palsy impacts the right side of my body, which means that I walk with a limp. Not everybody walks. It's a varying disability, but I walk with a limp. I have a slower reaction time on my right side. I have delayed motor skills on my right side as well. So I can't do things like open up jars or, you know, cabinets. I can do the refrigerator now with my right hand, which is a win, but I can't do a lot of things with my right side. Or if I have any sort of reaction time of something that's coming to me at the right side of my body, it's delayed, which means odds are if you're throwing something my way, I'm not going to be able to catch it with my right hand, even if you toss it. So a lot of my lived reality is just trying to use the left side of my body to sort of overcompensate for the right. And it just means that I can't do your everyday things specifically just with the right side of my body. My left side has to help.
So balance, I'm assuming, can be tricky too.
Yes. Oh, yes. Especially if I'm trying to balance on the right side of my body, like keep my left leg in the air. It's mm-hmm. like really hard to stand on one leg without any sort of support. So yes, balance is definitely an issue. I trip over air a lot, so there's that as well.
So when you were a child, you say in the book you didn't really know you had a disability for a very long time.
Yes, because my family, it's been my mom, my twin sister Leah, and my older brother Eric. It's just always been the three of us in our immediate family. And then I have a bunch of cousins and aunts and uncles, but they never treated me as though I was different from any other person in the family. It was always just like, oh, okay, so your siblings have scooters and rollerblades and bikes, you're going to get those same things. And so I never saw myself as somebody who was different from other people. I didn't even often look at myself in the mirror as a kid. So, like, not out of fear of anything, I just didn't have the time. I was always outside playing. So I never saw myself as disabled. I didn't think that I looked any different from my sister or my classmates. I really went into childhood thinking that, you know, I looked exactly like them when I walked, or, you know, they got tired too. I just really always believed that there was nothing different about me. And that's the way that my family treated me, was just that I was one of the other kids.
When did that change?
It changed for me when I was 12, because I was in middle school and there was a kid who was mocking the way that I was walking behind me in the lunchroom or the cafeteria, whichever you call it. And I didn't even know about it. My friends pointed it out to me that he was making fun of me, and then they jumped to my defense, which I think is a beautiful thing that not a lot of people who are disabled or in other marginalized communities, when you have those experiences of someone making fun of you, you don't immediately have people ready to defend you. And I did, but that's when I realized that not only was I disabled, but it was something that people could make fun of me for. And so I internalized that, and I was like, oh, I'm wrong. I'm broken from the age of 12, simply because this kid, who probably doesn't even remember that he did it, made fun of me in a cafeteria.
So you're 12 years old, you're heading into kind of a tough time for any teenager, the teenage years. How did you see your disability when you were a teen?
I mean, I saw it as a hindrance. I saw it as a pain. I saw it really as a punishment of sorts. I just didn't understand why I was the one who had to be disabled. And I internalized sort of feeling like other and wrong. And I was so afraid that everybody was going to start making fun of me the way that that kid did. And so I was really uncomfortable in my body from age 12 till like well into my 20s, because I just didn't know how the world was going to react to me. And so I was constantly trying to prepare myself for the worst possible situation. And I was really tearing myself down because of it.
In the book, you said something that really stuck with me. You said you have two families, that you were born into one and you chose the other. What did you mean by that?
I mean, with the gift of the internet, I mean, it comes with its flaws, but I found people outside of my family who share not only the lived experience of disability, but also who know disability at all. Like, some of them don't even know, you know, mental or emotional or what have you disability. So I think for me, I was able to choose people who saw me and see me every single day. And that's sort of a gift that not everybody gets to have. You don't always get to have a really good biological family and get to choose your own.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. In terms of technology, how has that enhanced your friendships and your relationships? I'm guessing it does different things for the people you know in real life and then the people that you've probably just met online as well. How has technology changed how you can have relationships?
Technology in this way is such a gift, because for the friends that I met initially online, we literally keep in touch through our phones because we're on Twitter together, Instagram, or Facebook, but mostly just Twitter. And we can talk about things that you wouldn't normally go to, say, your family member to talk about, or you could talk to them about, you know, the weather, but there's always this sort of connection and it doesn't break. And then with the friends that I've made in real life, technology has also strengthened our friendships, because when they move away or we, you know, have life changes, we can still keep in touch through the art and the act of technology. And so it's very special to me specifically because it strengthens both the friends that I've made in real life and the ones online. And then it crosses over too, because I meet those same friends in real life at some point. And, you know, and I have in my life. And so for me, it's just like it strengthens both of those relationships in very powerful ways.
Something I've always cracked up at this one line from The Mindy Project, where Mindy Kaling says, "Best friend isn't a person, Danny, it's a tear." And does that resonate with you?
Yeah. First of all, I loved The Mindy Project. So shout out to Mindy Kaling. It was amazing. But it does. I think there's such a wonderful place of emotion with friendships. Like I say all the time that my friends are the loves of my life because they loved me without obligation. So there's no like familial obligation, but they choose to love me and I choose to love them. And so for me, there's something really magical in being able to sit with somebody and cry or sit with somebody and not say anything. It doesn't always have to be about that joy and that happiness. We can be sad together too. And we can go through life's toughest times knowing that we have each other.
So you said you have a twin sister named Leah. Tell me about your relationship with her.
It's better now. I will say that. We get older. And so you start to realize that the petty stuff you cared about in high school or younger years don't matter as much. But when I was younger, I was very jealous of her because Leah is able-bodied. She doesn't have a physical disability. And I was very resentful of her for that because I was like, we're twins. So why was I the one with the disability? And because I saw one's disability as this very bad thing and this terrible thing that was a punishment to me, I took it out on her because I couldn't take it out on God. And so I was like, how dare you be the pretty one? Which is interesting because that's the name of the book. Mm-hmm. But I was like, how dare you be the pretty one? Everybody loves you. Boys keep asking me to put in a good word for you. And I don't have that same treatment. No one's ever going to feel that way about me. But it wasn't until I started feeling that way about myself that I realized all of these people that I love, these friends, they have all these wonderful qualities, but Leah has them too. And it took me going away to college to realize that all the stuff that I was seeking in my friends from away from home, I had in Leah. And it took me time to like be able to say, I want to get to know who she is, not who I've projected her to be.
One of the most difficult parts of your book for me was reading about kind of the unsolicited healing advice you'd get sometimes when you were very young from strangers. Can you share that story in the CD store?
Yeah. So I was 12. Again, what a year. And I was looking for an Avril Lavigne CD because I have taste. And this woman comes up to me and she goes, I don't know what's wrong with you, you know, but I'm praying for you and God heals all things. And then she just gives me a thumbs up and walks away. And that's happened to me. It happens to me even now. So it's been happening almost all my life where people just feel like they're doing something great by telling me that they feel sorry for me or that they're praying for me or that God sees me fit to be held or healed or whatever. I'm sorry. And it's just frustrating because I'm just trying to live my life. You know, I'm out with my friends in Walmart or I'm out at one of my friends' cottages or I'm doing something with someone and I'm just trying to be a quote unquote everyday normal person. But somebody always has to remind me that I'm other. And that's sort of the frustrating thing about it, because once I finally started to love myself, I got really tired of trying to defend myself from their questions or their quote-unquote concerns.
Did you struggle with that, wanting to solve or heal or pray away your disability when you were a teenager?
Oh, absolutely. I would pray to God every night to wake up in a able-bodied body. I would ask him that I would say, I don't know what I did wrong, but I'm sorry and I have learned my lesson, like every single night for years. So all of high school, even the first year of college, I was praying to God to put me in a different body. And I was apologizing to him for whatever it was that I did. And then I realized how messed up that was of me to think that there was something wrong of me living, like wrong for me to live in this body, and not that it wasn't by his actual design.
I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with journalist and creator of the hashtag Disabled and Cute, Kia Brown. Her book is called The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. When we come back, we'll talk about reclaiming the word disability.
I think disability and disabled is not a dirty word. I think oftentimes when we use these sort of euphemisms and sort of swap them out, it's because we're trying to make other people who aren't disabled feel comfortable. And I'm not in the business of making someone feel comfortable about my disability because it took me so long for me to feel comfortable. And so when doing this, I'm trying to stop the stigma of the word disability and the word disabled and try to get people to be like, yes, this person is disabled and I don't have to placate them by calling them handicapable or differently abled, because that's not what it is.
That's after a short break. is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kia Brown, creator of hashtag Disabled and Cute and author of The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. She joined us last year to talk about it. Let's return to the conversation where we begin with a clip from the NBC show Superstore.
I'm going to tell a story about how I ended up in this wheelchair.
Let's do two. Let's all do two.
I still haven't done my solution.
It was a drunk driver. Hit me while I was crossing the street. Guy came out of nowhere and bam!
Ooh.
Doc said I was lucky to be alive.
You are.
But my wheelchair was destroyed, so I had to get this one.
Okay.
That's actor Colton Dunn, who plays Garrett on NBC's Superstore. Now, Garrett's character on Superstore is a black man. He's in a wheelchair. May seem like a representation win. But why have some people had mixed feelings about that portrayal?
Because the actor himself is not disabled. And so at the end of the day, he gets up and goes out of the wheelchair. And the issue with that is a lot of disabled actors don't even get the roles of disabled people in the world. They don't even get the opportunity to play these people with this lived experience. And there's sort of a nuance that's missing when you cast someone who was not disabled to play someone disabled instead of casting an actual actor who lives in that experience. I personally love the show, but I do recognize that criticism is valid.
And there was a consultant hired, actually, to help kind of shape the role, which maybe, is that a step in the right direction or is that just not going far enough?
I think it is a step in the right direction. I think a lot of shows don't even go that far, so I think that's great. I do hope that in the future, when they are casting these sorts of roles, though, that they actually do give them to disabled actors.
Do you think that Hollywood is making progress? I know you're a huge fan of television in general. First of all, why don't you hit me with some of your favorite shows?
There's so many. I mean, I love Killing Eve. I love the new Charmed reboot. I'm really into that. I just started Nancy Drew on the CW. It's really good as well. There's just so much TV. And of course, I'm blanking. I love Superstore and I love The Good Place. And I'm really sad that The Good Place is ending. There's just so many shows to watch every single night. And I'm so lucky. Oh, I really like Almost Family on ABC right now as well.
So
it's really good.
How is Hollywood doing with representation progress? Are there steps in the right direction or is it woefully behind where it should be?
It's woefully behind where it should be. Because a lot of times when you see disabled representation in particular, it's usually men and they're usually wheelchair users and they're usually cis, straight, and white. Now, I am a black, bisexual, disabled woman. And so I've never seen anybody like me on our TV screens. And so the disabled narrative is very singular in that people come into disability and it's never that they're born with it. So it's always like, oh no, look at the life that they had before and now they're sad and depressed and how dare someone love them? And then someone might love them, but they'll end up killing themselves before the end of the movie or the TV show. And that's frustrating to me because I live my life leading with joy now, and I want to see characters that do the same thing. I want to create characters that do the same thing.
That's another interesting point. Let's talk about the writers' rooms. Are they filled with people that represent your experience, or is that a big problem too?
I think that's a big problem too. I mean, I was looking in research for the book, I was looking for people who identify in any way as disabled in writers' rooms, and I came up with nothing. And I think a part of that is because some people are afraid to disclose that they're disabled, because then there's a sort of stigma to disability that you can't really shake, and everybody thinks that it costs too much money to employ a disabled person, and it becomes this whole thing. And so it makes me sad that we're not even telling disabled stories. And then when we do, there aren't often people who think to hire consultants like NBC Superstore did or hire people who live that experience. They just want to go off with what they think disability is, or they'll talk to a parent of someone who's disabled. But I think that that does a disservice simply because when you're not talking to actual disabled people, you're not getting the full experience.
And you spoke about some of these problematic narrative devices, which is interesting. I'm able-bodied, and I haven't really thought too deeply about this, but when you point out some of the tropes that happen in books and TV and film, it's really hard to get past it now. I mean, the idea that, like, the benevolent suicide thing that happens at the end of movies like Million Dollar Baby or Me Before You, or there's a lot of narratives where someone was never sick to begin with, and all along it was just someone imposing something on them. When you see something like that play out, what does that say to the disabled community?
It says that we're not worthy of being alive, or we're not worthy of true, authentic stories. And for me, it's frustrating because you can love the actors or the people who participate in these movies and still see that, like, no, I'm not watching that because I'm tired of watching disabled people die. And I'm tired of watching us hate ourselves. And I'm tired of watching the same singular narratives because they hurt. It's not just about, you know, oh, no, I don't like that because it's not good. It's like, no, that actually hurts because it influences policy and it influences so many aspects of our actual lived reality that these movies are very harmful, because despite the fact that I absolutely love Hilary Swank, I also know that movies like that really influence the way that people see disability. And so when we're seeing that reflected back to us, that also impacts policy changes, and it also impacts the fact that we don't have the rights that we deserve or accessible spaces, because people think, oh, no, I mean, I watch Million Dollar Baby, so it must mean that nobody who's disabled would want to be alive. So how dare we cater this space or this thing or this, you know, facet of something like fashion or beauty to them, because they don't even want to be alive. And so it really does impact our greater society, because movies tend to do that. Movies and TV tend to reflect our society and our world back to us.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Andrea in Louisville. Go ahead.
Hi there. I am going to try to hold myself back from crying while I tell you what happened. So I was living in Boston, and my daughter was a cheerleader at Brookline High School, and she hurt her knee. She tore a ligament. And she always wanted to go to the New Year's Eve celebration in New York. So it was 2014, bringing in 2015. And she's on crutches because she hurt her knee, and it had to heal with a knee brace on. And we're standing in Times Square enjoying ourselves, and she's sitting on the ground in a freezing cold. And the guy next to me looks at me and says, you should get, well, he was fighting with me the whole time, but the comment that really hurt me says, you should get the Mother of the Year Award for bringing your disabled child to this event. And I wanted to tell him I should get the Mother of the Year Award because I've raised my daughter from the time I was pregnant and got divorced while I was pregnant, and she's 19 years old now and in college. So those kind of comments, and I actually wrote to the American Girl people who make those dolls because I wanted them to make a doll like that. They never responded. But for people to make comments like that, whether she was disabled or not or hurt, he had no idea what happened, but for him to make that kind of comment, and I actually wanted to write to the New Year's Eve people, they should make accommodations for people like that.
What do you think? Do you hear a lot of, oh, you should get an award or grab a medal for taking something like this on as a caregiver? What do you think about that, Kia?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, I mean, I get it a lot. I was once in an Uber, and the guy was like, I get in, and he goes, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, I have cerebral palsy. And he's like, oh, well, it's good that you know, got out of the house today. And I was like, well, yeah, I only have one life. I want to live it. And he was like, oh, well, I guess. So, oh. Of course, he didn't get 5 stars from me. But I think it happens all the time. People either are super proud of you for existing in the world, or they're super rude about you taking up space. And I find that a lot of places aren't accessible. And so when people think about disability, they do think about it as a permanent thing. But even for people with temporary disabilities, like a broken leg or a broken arm, that's when you should really be thinking about accessibility, too, because we need those all the time. But when you see that people are doing these things where they're like either mocking disabled people or so proud that we exist in the world or left the house because they would never. I get a lot of people saying, like, I don't know how you live with disability. Like, I would kill myself. I've been told that multiple times. And it is frustrating because people don't think about what they say before they say it. So, yeah, I've definitely experienced that. And I really do feel sorry for you and your daughter who have had to experience that in a place like New York City that is supposed to be so progressive and so above, you know, these sorts of things.
So you have said, Kia, that you will never use language that kind of swaps in synonyms for disabled, words like differently abled or handicapable. Handicapable has always come off to me kind of like 95 years young. Why do you prefer disabled to these other options?
Because I think disability and disabled is not a dirty word. I think oftentimes when we use these sort of euphemisms and sort of swap them out, it's because we're trying to make other people who aren't disabled feel comfortable. And I'm not in the business of making someone feel comfortable about my disability because it took me so long for me to feel comfortable. And so when doing this, I'm trying to stop the stigma of the word disability and the word disabled and try to get people to be like, yes, this person is disabled and I don't have to placate them by calling them handicapable or differently abled, because that's not what it is. It's a disability, and there's nothing wrong with it being the word disability, because there's nothing wrong with disability itself. And I think those other words sort of give off the vibe that there's something wrong with disability.
Can you share other examples of how sometimes the comfort of able-bodied people wins out over what might be best for the disabled community?
Oh, yes. Whenever I'm, like, traveling somewhere, I tend to do the wheelchair-requested assistance because I can't walk long distances. But people scoff and they roll their eyes when they see me get out of the wheelchair to get to my plane seat. People are often looking for disabled people in any public space to move out of the way or let them just pass or do something that makes it easier for them. So I'm left-handed, and as I said earlier, my right hand isn't as strong. So when I go up and downstairs, I need the railing. So if I'm, you know, coming down the stairs and somebody's coming up, I can't move my hand, and they get upset at the idea that they would have to move for me. And that's me being visibly disabled. It's even worse for people who are invisibly disabled, and people just assume that you're trying to pull one over on them. And it's like, no, I literally cannot get down these stairs or do this thing because of the lack of balance that I have that's even. But people don't really think about those sorts of things. They just think about the fact that you're inconveniencing them. Like, I was in the airport yesterday, and I was standing waiting for the wheelchair to be inspected, and so I was holding on to something. And this woman was really upset because I didn't move out of her way. And I was like, listen, if I let go of this, I could fall. And that's the lived reality. Like, I could actually fall, but she didn't care.
There's been a whole social media practice now of people having to, like, post why they have a handicap tag on their car, for example, because people love to shame folks for parking in a spot near the store.
They do. I got shamed once. My mom got out of the car first, and I was, like, tying my shoe. And this lady knocks on the window, and she goes, you know that that's for people with a disability. And so I put my right hand up to the window. I said, you were saying? And she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. There were just, you know, police here, and I didn't want you guys to get in trouble. But that's not really what it was. What it was that she assumed that because my mom got out of the car first, that we were just, you know, finessing a handicapped parking spot label thing.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Why do you think so many able-bodied people just even bother with trying to shame someone for parking in a handicapped spot, for example? What is going on there?
I think because it makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they're doing a good deed for the day by shaming someone who they think parked in a parking spot that doesn't belong to them. But in reality, because we live in a world where there are both visibly and invisibly disabled people, you can't just assume that somebody's pulling one over on someone else. And I think people are so eager to be nosy. And I mean, I'm nosy for my job, so I get it. But at the same time, it's like, you can't make assumptions like that. And we're not good deeds. We're not something you check off of your list. Don't use me to shame someone else to make you feel good about the life that you live.
Do you think able-bodied people often put disabled people in a box of either pity or anger for misunderstanding because it makes them feel better about themselves because they can think, well, at least I'm not in that situation?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the culture of what I call inspiration porn, which is just videos on the internet or things that people, stories that people tell about disabled people, and they're just like, oh my God, if they could do it, I could do it. And so they use disabled people and don't see them as people. What they do instead is see us as sort of goal markers for their own lived realities. So it's like, my life may be bad, but at least it's not that bad, sort of thing. And I think people feel so comfortable using disabled people as sort of their shields to what their life could be like. And they just assume that it's so bad and that they would be so miserable like this. And that's how they sort of operate. And that's how our larger culture operates. And it breaks my heart because that's not my lived reality. I have so much joy in my life now. And I think that when I see these videos in particular about, like, oh, this person is driving with their foot, or this person did this thing, it's not about being proud of them for doing something amazing. It's about being proud of them for doing something, for adapting to a you know, inaccessible world, but it's under the guise of being like, oh my gosh, we should cheer them on just because they're disabled, or we should cheer them on just because that's not how we live. And isn't our life so much better than this? Look what you have, blah, 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 and I hate it.
I love the way you write about the intersections of identity. Like, you are a Black disabled woman. Do you feel like you're fighting for representation on three different stages or one?
Three. Well, not four, because I came out last week. Okay. But I think, yeah, I'm constantly fighting for representation in every community, because a lot of times the communities get stuck on the quote-unquote bigger picture. So the disability community has to contend with its own racism, sexism, and homophobia. And, you know, the female community has to identify, like, cope with their own sexism, racism, and internalized homophobia. And the Black community has to do the exact same thing. And the gay community has to deal with their own, you know, racism and all of that as well. So it's like you're fighting different battles with communities that help you feel seen, but also can hurt you in that way. And I think that's a marker of a larger problem in our society as a whole. But it's like you can't please everybody, but I think you should at least try to make sure that the people in the world that we live are reflected back to us in a positive way.
Is that exhausting? I mean, if you feel like you have all these different intersections of identity and all of them need attention from the world, is it hard to keep all of those kind of fights moving forward sometimes?
Yes. Oh my God, it's a lot of hard work. It's very exhausting. But for me, I've always wanted to see that representation. And this is something that I've always wanted to do in my career. So even when I'm exhausted by it, and there are definitely days when I am, I sort of push myself forward, because I say, you know, if you don't do it, you're never going to be satisfied, because it's not, like, assumed that someone else will.
I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with journalist and creator of hashtag Disabled and Cute, Kia Brown. Her book is called The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. When we come back, we'll talk about what helps during difficult days.
It's really hard sometimes when your life changes and it sort of upends you and you forget who you are as a person. But I will say that what has helped me is finding things that I enjoy. And so sometimes it means watching rom-coms all day, or eating my favorite comfort food, or just trying to find something to laugh about throughout the day. And so maybe when you're at work or you're heading to work, play a song that you love, or just do something that makes you happy, and know that joy isn't always there, but you can find it in the small spaces of every day.
That's when Think continues. This is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kia Brown, creator of hashtag Disabled and Cute, and author of The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. She joined us last year to talk about it. Let's return to the conversation. So, Kia, I feel like most people use the word ableism pretty fluidly by now, but can you give me your definition of it?
For me, ableism is the mistreatment, or sort of the mistreatment of disabled people by an able body, by a person who is not disabled, simply because that person is disabled. And it sort of is the marker of people who feel very comfortable in their able-bodiedness, and ableism really is a result of them feeling superior to disabled people.
How does the fashion industry and also the beauty industry push ableism?
Well, and I love both, I want to be clear about that, but they do push ableism because they have either one token disabled person who is a wheelchair user and no other types of disability represented. And they usually only have one of us in a campaign. And that's just never walking in fashion shows. In most any fashion shows, you don't see disabled people walking runways. You don't see us in the ads for, you know, lipsticks or makeup or clothes. You just see us maybe in a one-off picture on a website. Just the one, though. So that's the quota that they hit, is the one person. And then instead you see this sort of hailing of the Eurocentric beauty standards, you know, a skinny, white, able-bodied person who is seen as beautiful, and people like me aren't at all seen in the beauty spaces, and we don't get that same sense of attention or care when we are absolutely giving our money to these same industries, but we're not being catered to, because often even clothes are made with asymmetrical bodies in mind, and or symmetrical bodies in mind, mm-hmm. I mean, and you don't see bodies like mine being catered to. Like, it's hard for me to get buttons up sometimes, but it's very rare that you find that fashion companies or houses are even catering to disabled customers. I know that Tommy Adaptive is one that's doing it. Zappos has a line, and Open Style Lab is doing really great work, but it shouldn't just be on the three of them to do it.
And one thing you said in the book was that a lot of times folks with disabilities will end up paying twice because they'll buy whatever they're going to buy. If it's a garment of clothing, then maybe they have to get it altered as well. So, I mean, if it's up to, they're consuming it. They're consuming it with even more money than the able-bodied community might be.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm a person who loves clothes. I love fashion. So I'm constantly buying, clothes, finding any excuse to like get online and go shopping. But for me and my friends, yeah, sometimes you have to tailor something just so it can fit you. Like, I have friends who are little people, and my friend Rebecca Coakley, who is a little person, has to get her clothes tailored because they're not being made with her body in mind. My friend Valissa also has to get her clothes tailored. And I have friends who can't even wear shoes because they haven't found shoes that fit them and are comfortable. So it's really it's a tough call with these communities, because you can love them so much, but they don't necessarily love or care for you back. And I'm hoping that that's a yet at the end of that. I hope that it comes in my lifetime, because I love clothes so much, and I love fashion, and I love beauty, and I just want to be loved back by them.
One thing you speak about in the book is wanting to fall in love, but not being afraid of the heartbreak. What do you mean by that?
I'm a rom-com aficionado, so I'm familiar with the idea of heartbreak, and I'm not even upset about it, simply because I think there's so much beauty in the fact that it happened at all. And for me, to be in love is as beautiful as to be heartbroken, because it means that someone cared about you enough, or you cared about someone enough for them to love you outside of familial obligation or platonic love, which I think they're both very important. But I also think there's something beautiful about being loved romantically, and I do really hope that that happens for me someday.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Rod in North Richland Hills. Rod, go ahead.
Yes. My name is Rod, and I wanted to talk to the person about, I guess, I had a stroke. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what... the depression that I'm feeling, the lack of being able to, I was married prior to that. Mm-hmm. But I'm an attorney also. I go to court, and I'm trying to make the best of my life. I don't know what she's doing now.
So I guess, how do you stay so resilient, Kia? So he had a stroke and is obviously mm-hmm. battling depression and the physical symptoms that come with a stroke in recovery. How do you stay so resilient?
I mean, for me, and I go through seasonal depression myself, and so I feel for you there. For me, it really is about trying to find small reasons to get out of bed every day, and trying to remind myself that my sadness is keeping me from a fully realized life. And it is really hard because, again, as a person who suffers from seasonal depression, it's really hard sometimes when your life changes and it sort of upends you and you forget who you are as a person. But I will say that what has helped me is finding things that I enjoy. And so sometimes it means watching rom-coms all day, or eating my favorite comfort food, or just trying to find something to laugh about throughout the day. And so maybe when you're at work or you're heading to work, play a song that you love, or just do something that makes you happy, and know that joy isn't always there, but you can find it in the small spaces of every day.
You are clearly, Kia, someone who loves herself completely now, but depression and even thoughts of suicide weighed on you for a long time. When do you think you were at your lowest?
I think I was at my lowest in college, both my freshman year, right before my grandmother passed, and my senior year right before I was getting ready to graduate because I didn't know what was going to happen in my life and I didn't know who or where I was going to be. I mean, so I think those 2 years in particular were really low because they were the markers of change. And I find that often I get really sad at the idea of change and it sort of scares me into a place where I'm not comfortable and I like to be comfortable. So yeah, those 2 years for me were really bad because I was like, I don't know who I am and if I'm worthy of even being alive. Like, I'm disappointing everyone. I just kept thinking that I was disappointing, you know, my grandmother and disappointing the world at large. And so I was very depressed and very eager to sort of say goodbye to life itself.
Do you think a lot of that came from kind of internalizing the external, you know, the way that you consume media and heard from people that you hadn't asked advice from or, you know, jokes that were made at your expense? As resilient and joyful of you as always seemed as a person, did a lot of that make its way inside of you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the marker for every time that I felt bad about myself, every sort of ounce of depression for a very long time was so intrinsically tied to the way that I saw myself outwardly in the way that the world saw me. So I would internalize those things and use them as proof that I didn't belong on the earth because I wasn't worthy or because I wasn't able-bodied or because I wasn't beautiful.
How did books, in a way, really kind of save you?
Because they were an escape. And I think that's in part why I love them so much, because they allowed me to escape my own mind. And so it was like for a few hours or for hundreds of pages, I could stop being so hard on myself and stop calling myself names and stop tearing myself down under the guise of trying to prepare myself for when the world did with books. I could just fall in love with other characters and think for a moment that I could have that too, even if it was a fleeting moment. I could use books as a place to escape and a place to dream of a better life for myself.
And as we've spoken so much about representation, you don't see yourself in every book, but you can see parts of yourself in different books.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I love Sarah Dessen's books so much growing up, and I love them now, because I don't see myself as a Black woman in these books, but they helped me save myself in the long run. And when we lost Toni Morrison, I was gutted because I did the same thing in her books. And she didn't often talk about disability, but when she talked about the Black experience, I felt like I felt beautiful too because I was Black. I felt beautiful too because I could be the person that she was talking about. And so to lose her really crushed me.
Can you talk about what changed? When did you decide to pull yourself in a very different direction and really start living your life?
It was 2016, actually. My career was going really well. I was publishing in places that I had always dreamed of publishing. And I was like, if my work is worthy, then maybe I can be worthy too. And so just after Christmas, I sort of walked into my bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I felt really cute for the first time. And this had been a fleeting, you know, experience in the past. Like, I would feel cute and then I'd be like, oh no, you're not cute. But then I just sort of practiced every day with those things in the mirror, saying those things that I liked about myself until it stuck. And that's kind of how I created the hashtag and how I really started to see worth outside of the work, but in me as well as a human being.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. So let's talk about the hashtag disabled and cute. I mean, when you mention a hashtag, it seems like something that can be so fleeting or even flippant. But for you, it really meant something, not just to you personally, but the response has been astounding. Talk to me about that creation. You call it almost like a baby in the book, right? You had this baby.
Yeah. I was like, I had this child that was weighing in on. But yeah, I mean, for me, the hashtag started as a very singular thing. So I created disabled and cute to commemorate the fact that those times that I said those things nice about myself in the mirror from the end of 2016 to the beginning of 2017, that was just to mark that I was finally feeling good. And so I posted those four pictures on Twitter, as one does, and I used the hashtag, and then I left because I'm a writer who's always on deadline.
Right.
And I went to do work, and I came back, and it was trending. And then by the end of the week, it went viral, and then the end of next week, it was global. And the response really was just disabled people sharing what they loved about themselves, even if it wasn't with pictures, or even if they were unsure of that love, they were talking about their journeys. And so the hashtag has remained relevant, you know, years later, because people are using it as a place for them to announce that they love themselves and that they're not going to keep tearing themselves down, because that's what society often tells us that we should do.
Were you caught off guard by the response?
Oh, absolutely. I never do anything thinking that anybody's going to pay attention to it. I didn't write the book thinking that anybody outside of my college friends would read it, just because I knew that if I thought of the audience, I would write a completely different book that I wasn't happy with. But yeah, I was very surprised by the response, because I didn't think that anybody would care enough to actually do it. I had hoped that people would use it, but I didn't think that they actually would. And so for people to even tell me, you know, I'm a fan of yours because of the hashtag, or I'm a fan of yours because of the thing that you wrote, it's wild. Like, I have fans. How amazing is that? And so for me, it's really just about the fact that that's the best gift that I could have been given with regard to the hashtag, is that people found themselves within it and are able to celebrate themselves. And some people fell in love from the hashtag and they started dating, and now they're very happy together. And it's just really nice that I was able to give a community something that will last long after I'm gone.
When you think about where you were at your lowest, when you were contemplating suicide and really not wanting to live and waking up and remembering that it was a new day and not feeling happy about that, when you think about that woman and then now you've become someone who people are reaching out to and saying, you're teaching me to love myself, is that kind of an amazing journey for you to comprehend that you made?
Oh, yeah. I'm a major sap. I'm a very sappy person. So I cry a lot. I wrote a whole essay about it in the book as well. I enjoy crying. I think that for me to have those sort of responses from complete strangers, so it's not even people who know me or knew me beforehand, it's people who have come to my work, to be able to say that I impacted someone else's life positively when I spent so long not wanting to live at all, it's beautiful, and I'm definitely not taking it for granted, because I think it's a gift.
Now, we only have a little bit of time left, but one of my favorite things when reading the book is you constantly kind of reference some of your favorite things. Give me a list of some of your favorites, because it made me want to either watch or consume or eat or try on everything you said.
Oh, yeah. I love Christian Siriano. He's an amazing fashion designer. I love cheesecake and pizza and rom-coms and TV shows and movies. I like to watch stuff blow up, so I was really into the Expendables movies for a while there, because I'm a person who loves both action and romantic comedies, and I just love cheeseburgers, and I'm a very big food person. So a lot of my favorite things really involve either food, friends, TV, but if I can bring them together, it's the best time. Like, I love playing cards with my friends. We're a very big card friend group, especially my friends from college. We spent a lot of time playing card games like 313 and Phase 10. And I just think that there's such a good way to connect to people, is finding something that you all enjoy doing. Like, I love concerts as well. I just went to the Jonas Brothers concert in California. That was a fantastic time. I think that if you can find something that you can connect with people activity-wise, it's a really great way to get to know people, and it's a really great way to get to know yourself as well.
That was my conversation with journalist and creator of hashtag Disabled and Cute, Kia Brown. She joined us last year to talk about her book, The Pretty One, on life, pop culture, disability, and other reasons to fall in love with me. If you enjoyed this show, check out our conversations with Nnedi Okorafor about her book, Broken Places and Outer Spaces, and with Linda Holmes about her book, Evie Drake Starts Over. Those podcasts are on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.